Hello, everybody. Welcome to the new bonus episodes, or the bonus series, for the second season. I attended the Costa Rican Big Data School, and, you know, I thought that maybe some of you can take some value out of this. You know, many aspiring computer scientists and software engineers would really benefit from the things that they talk about in this event. This was a five-day event from Monday through Friday, from 8 to 4, so it was pretty extensive, and they talked about a lot of different subjects and, you know, very important things that you got to know in this day and age with big data and data science and data analysis. So I thought, you know what? I'll put this up. Maybe some of my listeners can take advantage of this and can benefit from listening to really, really high-end professors from the Texas Advanced Computing Center. So our instructors will be Wei-Ya Xu. He's a PhD and the group lead for Data Mining and Statistics Group. Prior to joining TAC, he obtained a master's degree in biological sciences and a doctoral degree in computer science from the University of Texas at Austin. Then there's also Charlie Day. Charlie Day is the Director of Training and Professional Development with the User Services Group at TAC, with a background in web development and scientific computing. Charlie's responsibilities at TAC include organizing, developing content, and building curriculums for TAC's academic course selection taught in conjunction with several departments at the University of Texas at Austin, as well as for TAC's professional development and educational team. Oh, well. Oh, and just a quick thanks to Danny Xie, who was the one who recorded these segments. Without him, we wouldn't have this awesome bonus round. So thank you very much, and enjoy.
And I think part one is factor. What the features there, and what you should pay attention to, and what you should know. That is a difference than other tongue language or tools or libraries you may already familiar with. Just a quick summary about the last slide here. Zapier is one of the open source tools that are out there. It really has really nice integration with Spark. So if you are interested in the big data or interested in your data analysis in general, you can pick it up. And it's similar to the Jupyter's, and it also has some complementary features to the Jupyter's as well. I have both installed on my laptop, so it depends on which type of program I'm writing. So sometimes I use this, sometimes I use that. So it's a really nice tool.
Why this garbage is not working?
You can actually,
fucking open source.
I don't know if I showed that slide already or I haven't, but you can actually go to their website and download it and install it on your laptop. And it has the data, it has the
font,
and the
ODE
in there. If you are having some stuff or have hard stuff, it also can allow you to do the PySpark and Python and the R within there. So the next thing is about the Sparks, I want to, probably the last thing is I have
yes,
time to introduce within the Sparks topic is Sparks has a very nice machine learning libraries. So far we have talked about is the storage, the data representation. So both of them are very important and they are important now on the practical day how your data need to be stored. But also important for you to know so you can write a program and effectively can use for processing them. But when we talk about the data analysis, we're not going to be just do summary statistics. I'm not going to be just playing data around. So the Spark also has a very nice library called the MLLib, standing for the machine learning libraries. So it is a library implementing a common set of machine learning algorithms that can help you to do some more complex and advanced analysis on your large data side. What you can get out of the MLLib is it's a scalable, it's a native implementation on the with Spark. So it works well with Spark's base programming framework, and so it scales well with the different structures. You can debug your code in a single node in your laptop, and then if you deploy it into a large Spark cluster, it works equally well. And it's also very efficient. So we know that Spark itself is implemented in Scala. Scala itself is a quite efficient language, but you may also hear about the comparison to say Java is slow, C is faster, Python is faster, Julia is even better, or something like that. With the machine learning library, so I don't want to get into an argument. I'm a Java programmer. I actually know C, Java, Python, Julia, SQL, maybe six, seven different programming languages myself. So I don't really have a bias into different programming language. But the thing with the machine learning library is the high-level interface are through the Scala, but a lot of the ML there is the lower-level computation is actually done through a C-level base on its own. So itself is actually quite efficient than a native Java program or native Scala program, even more. The other things why I recommend the ML Lab and also people to learn it, is that it has a very nice API, and it unifies different type of machine learning algorithms into a somewhat unified interface, so it's easier for people to pick up and to code with it. But the one limitation is ML Lab is just one library. It doesn't cover all the machine learning algorithms. One is because there's literally could be thousands of different machine learning algorithms out there people existing. But practically, you really do not need to run all thousands of problems and machine learning algorithms. But another important reason is MLLM is built up on top of Spark. Now, all the machine learning algorithm or machine learning process is compatible with Spark type of programming framework. So the MLLM only has the one that suitable or has a good match with Spark there. So knowing that, you know the limitation, but you also have the confidence to say, if the MLLM is supporting that, you can have a fairly confidence about its efficiency and about its scalability. Okay? So in the next couple of slides, I want to, basically the scalability is coming from the Spark system and platform, so that's the thing we have been talking about over and over. So efficient comes about implementation. So the thing I really want to introduce here is the MLLM APIs and why it became easy to use and it's a recommended to use. So first of all, it's a maybe a lesser issue now, but for a while, after they start to introduce a data frame concept and the data set concept, so for a while even now, there's coexisted two sets of the MLLM libraries. One is the original one that is RDP-based API. It's a start with spark.mllm. And then the newer one is called spark.ml. So if you're coding something, you may see both of them existing. So most part, the RDP-based API has been migrated into the data frame-based API. So you should just pick up the spark.ml whenever possible. But that's also the part when I answered the previous question on why we need converting them back to RDB, just some of the function or some of the library may only has the RDB interface. So that's where you might need the converting them back to do the Spark, to do the RDB based API. So for the rest of them, since eventually the RDB based API should go away, so I do not want to focus too much on RDB based API here. So the rest of them is more focused on the data frame based API. So the two APIs, they accomplish the same set of things. Now I think data frame basically have a full coverage of the older algorithm APIs. It's more user friendly, and it works directly on the data frame, so it's easier. But also, it introduced a concept called a pipeline, a machine learning pipeline. This is like the data frame, this is not a invention of the Spark itself, it's a concept that existed in some other machine learning libraries long before the MLLM existed. So probably it's coming from another very good Python library called scikit-learn. Scikit-learn also using the same type of the idea of the pipelines. So what's a pipeline for, or in this concept, is the pipeline is a representation of the entire workflow of your machine learning analysis you want to apply to your data. So they want to, so the basic form is that they want the program on how you program is you want to combine multiple processing steps together. And your, say you have your raw data sitting on your disk, the first you may not be able to directly use them, you need to do certain data conversions and format conversions and maybe scaling them, normalizing some of those data. So that's what we typically call the data processing steps. Then you have an algorithm. Algorithm could be classification, clustering, and then you have evaluations. At the end, you evaluate how effective the algorithm applies to this type of insight or to this. So we, before the pipeline, and usually what we do is we just code them up, right? Separately, you have a function, or you have a library to do data processing, and library or function to do the algorithm, and you have a function to do the evaluation. Just run sequentially. In the pipeline, the idea of the pipeline is to, once you implement in those, you put them into a kind of the one object that can capture those. Right, so not only put them together, but also we, in the MLM, is to define the interface in between each of the processing tasks. So it's much like one of the big things with the big data is this moving from the data representation. So what the ML pipeline trying to do is trying to give a unified analysis representations of different analysis steps. So that way we can easily interchangeable different analysis tasks. So there, for example, if your goal is to do some classification, there are actually a number of different methods you could apply to it. If each of them have their own unique interface, it may come with a nightmare when you want to switch from one type of algorithm to another type of algorithm. If they all share some sort of the abstract interface, then it will be much easier, right? So this is a problem on top of you. So that's one of the ideas of the pipeline, and one of the features with it, why do we want to recommend people to use it. So in the machine learning, in the MLM, there are essentially three types of the interface, unified interface to cover the steps. So here, we call the transformers, estimators, and the parameters. So the transformer here is more corresponding to how you want to change or describe your data and how you want to run your algorithms. So estimator is more like your prediction models. And the parameters is to capture different type of parameters might be required with different type of algorithm there. They also now have a new interface called evaluators as well, so that can give us some sort of the uniform interface to give the evaluation. But still, the evaluation is much harder because for even the analysis algorithm different purpose, the evaluation can be quite different as well. So, for today, I'm just going to go into a little more details to the transformer estimators and how they fit together within the pipeline concept and how, why you should want to use them instead of writing them as a separate construct. Transformer. Okay, any questions so far about MLM and the pipeline ideas? Okay. So, transformer. I also have an icon that is a, you, do you know, do you guys know the animation, the movie, the Transformers? Yeah, I used to have them, now I can't even they be looking too old for it. Yeah, so what the robot does is it can transform itself from robot form to a car form, so, right? So the transformer here has a similar idea. It has a, it's a class, and then they have an object behind that class. But what they share is for all the transformers, they have to be able to transform from one form to another, right? So what they are transformed here is now from the Android to car, but they converting, basically what they do is they converting an input data frame into a new data frame, right? So just by this statement, it seems no difference on what you have been talking about. You have RDD, you do something that new RDD. You have a date frame, you do something that new date frame. In fact, the transformer does the same thing, and you have date frame, you go through this processing, you get a new date frame. But the transformer here is much more complex than a simple my function or my group my functions. You can either give it a purpose to it. Say you can do a feature selection with your transformers. You can match the values into new set of values. You can add new columns. You can combine certain columns into new features. So that's all the things you want to do when you do the analysis to change your data frame from one format, one form to another. So all those type of needs is a transformation. So not only the feature selection and some of the analysis like the inference, sometimes can also be treated as a transform function. They basically transform your input data into a set of labels. So you think about the prediction here is also a transform function. Is I have this bunch of the data input. I want to base on those values and make predictions. So my input is a data frame and my output is another data frame. I just release my results here. So explicitly putting inference here, because when the first time when I introduced them with some emphasizes, people may have the confusion, think about inferences and inferences on transformation, especially combined to the next concept we're going to introduce, which are the estimators. So transformers is like how your data frame being processed, what's the input, what's the output. So the estimator is what trying to capture the algorithm you want to perform on it, right? So it can be a learning algorithms, or it can be some other feature extraction algorithm that doesn't really transform your data from one data frame to another data frame, but transform into something else. So those are things that belong to the estimator type of the class. So the transformer and estimator are two high-level abstract classes. And within under each of them, there's a number of things being implemented. Typically, the inference function, the models, and then the pre-processing function, they're all coming from the transformers, and then all the learning algorithms, and all the really algorithms you want to apply to your data to generating the model is coming from estimators. So the transformers is a data frame in, data frame out, and the estimators usually is a data frame in and then a model out. That model is what you use for the rest of the pipeline. So similarly, like all the transformers share this function of transform, the estimators share this function called fit. Right? So they basically have this model, they are trying to fit your data into this model. Or you have an algorithm that will fit your data into this particular algorithm or distribution. So the output is always another class called models here. Okay. So the model is also part of this pipeline, right? So can you guess this model is an estimator or model is a transformer? Did I hear transformers? It's actually correct. Model is a transformer because like your estimator is to build this model. It's a learning algorithm. So once you build this model, you want to use the model to transform your raw data into a set of labels to make the predictions. So in the notebook I gave you, at the end, there's an analysis example. It's a very simple machine learning pipeline examples. In this examples, we put the some SQL, data frame SQL all together. And here, what I want to highlight is, let's just go through the code here. Can you see this clearly? If not, you can go to the notebook or go to the slide to see them. So this is the same data set, right? So what we do, the first line, you have seen them several times, and we are trying to read the data from this particular file here. And this is a video I have shown you. Contains each row is a car, and each column is a different properties of the car. So once we read this one in, and then it became data frame, and then we can call select functions. In here, I use yet another new ways to do the select. So in Spark, if you haven't noticed in Scala, you can chain all those commands together. So essentially, you don't need to write them at single lines. You can, the result of read will be packed into the format, you can pack into option, pack into row. Then the result of those is a different that will be packed into the next one. Right? So you can write them in a very compact, nice way. But when you read them, it's more like you're reading a language, but describing how things will be done. So here, since I don't want to create a separate tables that breaks my chainings, or I don't want to chain anymore select groups together. So I do another way of select expressions, and it works similar, as I can pass the SQL statement there, but only works on this particular table. So for this one, I selected the models here. I did some weird thing here, so MPG plus 0.0 as MPG. Anyone can guess what I'm trying to do here? Y plus 0.0. Yes?
To cast it to double.
Yes, exactly. So I'm trying to cast it into a double format. There's maybe three other ways I can think of to do this cast. There's a cast function, you can directly pass a cast as a double of MPG, or you can, and yet there's actually options when you read the files, you can do infer the schema. What it does is it will automatically try to infer in your column which type it is for your column. So for most time, it can automatically recognize your this is an integer or this is double columns. So there's really a number of ways to do this. Here I'm just choose a silly way to do that. Another reason I want to do that is to show with the select expressions, you can actually put in them as expressions into there. And what it does is later it will push them together internally as a SQL statement and to run. So that's the usual things you may, whatever usual things you could do with the regular SQL selections, you can do them here. And similarly, the S, so I give a new name to it. Most of them are the same name, but the other one, the centimeters, I change the name instead of calling it centimeter, I call the labels here. So that's the first line, is the reading and the selecting subset of the data. Then the next thing is I do split this data into training types, training data set, and testing data set. So do you know also why we need a training and a testing? Okay. I just saw one. No. One. We'll talk about training testing. It's important to have a separate training and testing data set so you can train something on a subset of data by testing it later on different set of data. Okay. So here, just for the illustration purpose, my pipeline is actually simple. I only have two states, one transformer and one transformer. So what my transformer does is a building function called vector assemblers. And what I want to do is remember when we read the data in, each one became a column. But sometimes I want to have a vector representation of my data. And now all the columns I may need it here, right? So again, there could be a different way to do it. The way I'm showing here is basically to say, from here, I'm going to select those columns and make them a new array of it, so they became A vectors. Then I will call this new array as a features, okay? So that's the transformation I want to do. So first I read the data, here at the data frame with all the columns, then my transformation is simply selecting five columns on top of it and build a feature vectors for my data to be using each row instead of using all those. And you can have a different way, different transformer for that. Then the next part is I define a estimators. In this case, the estimator is the logistic regressions. So how many of you know logistic regressions? So you know that logistic regression is basically trying to fit the data into a function. So I have now, I have a one transformer called assemblers and one estimators for the logistic regressions. Then I build up my pipeline here. It's a new pipeline. Then I set stage. The stage is another array. Each element is one of the transformer or estimators. So basically, my pipeline only has a two stage. The first goes through assemblers and then goes through the estimators here. So once we build this, the pipeline itself is estimators, and I can call the estimator to fit my training data set. And then what this one will generate is a model. It's a parameters that I can satisfy my patient under this condition when it's not just regression. And then the last thing is I want to, once I have this model, remember this model is also a transformer, so then I can apply this model to transform my textual data set, which has the same format input from my initial data frame. Then, if you generate my prediction, the prediction by default, it will have certain columns, it will have a label and the prediction values. So the label is the labels I'm putting here that comes with the original data frame. So that here is your true ground truth of what it should be. And then the prediction is here. Then there's evaluators. You can calculate false positive rate, true positive rates with it as well. Then you can show the result labels. Okay? No, it's not the code. Single code here is yet another way how you can specify a column. So remember, we already seen two ways. One is a double code, and it targets to capture the columns. And the other one is a dollar sign double code. So the double code, we treat them as a column name, just as a string, so it's a string input. Then the dollar one, we treat them as a columns. And this one is also a way to say we treat them as columns, but we cannot do the expression with them directly. So yeah. The Spark has a lot of those type of functions, and they have exactly the same format, but they can take different type of input as an input, and they do things, they have a different behaviors later. Any other questions? Yeah, that's actually a good catch. So if you notice through my exercise, was there a question?
The arguments in the function for the train sample, the poles and the point, what do they
represent? The
arguments inside the function for the sample train, the poles and the point.
Which function?
Is
a sample?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So there's a sample method. The false is whether you want to have a it's called like whether you want to have a redundant. So there are two ways sample. So you sample it from the side, you put them out, it doesn't go back. So the next time you sample a different one. And so false is means we don't put them back. If you do true, you sample once, you get them. And then you put them back, you sample again. So your sample data may have a redundant. So a lot of the functions are very interesting. This is one way you can do it. They also offer another function called split, where you can just randomly split into two parts, and that's easier. And here I'm just throughout my exercise, if you really pay attention to, you will notice. I'm purposely trying to using different ways and to show you there's different possibilities of how you can do something. The reason I'm doing that is I also want to show off the exact function. So it's basically to a subtraction from one different from the other to come together by some kind. Yes. Yes. Yes, I don't have them here, so we can run the actual code. What it does is when you do the transfer, it already generating a result, and the result has a certain format. So the other things you can call is called evaluator interface. The evaluator interface can automatically generate you say F value or F measures on certain things depending on which is applicable to it. So you can get the accuracy values and you can get your prediction accuracy as well. I didn't show that function here. And what I was trying to do is if you run this code, you will see I select some of three columns from the result. So the result itself is a display. There's a lot of columns. Then from that result, you can do your own manipulation to say, you can calculate it again, how many predictions are consistent, how many predictions are consistent, you can calculate your own corresponding. The evaluators is not perfect yet. It only support a limited number of the ways how you can manipulate. And also it's a different depending on which algorithm you want to use. Any other questions with this code? So the code is largely just like several steps. Prepare this side, assemble feature vectors, define analysis, and run the analysis, and see the results. My purpose is more show off the machine learning pipeline things. So for this, my pipeline is the vector assemblers and logistic regressions. Then my training data set, when I call the pipeline to say do a fit function, then I have training data set as input, the vector assemblers to assemble the vectors, with the logistic regressions, we are generating a model out. So the model itself, it's a replication of your entire pipeline, right? It has the same transformation function, transformation stage you already put in your pipeline. But they replace the estimator, the algorithm you're using. This is how the algorithm was assembled initially. They replace it with the actual inference models input back into your return pipeline here. Yes. I don't know why I don't know under what circumstance we told that, but in this particular cases, you can output the weights for each of the terms for your models. So later you can actually output that equations here. Maybe some other program doesn't allow you to do that, but in the Spark, you definitely can do this. And even with the deep learning, if you want to see all the weights, right, maybe 10,000 of them, you could. But just even you see it, it may not make sense to you, or you may not make further use of it. But it's definitely possible if you want to see what's value for each place I'm using and generating. So the point, go back to here, the point is when you build a pipeline, apply the data to it, it's generating another sort of pipeline here. And then that pipeline will apply a new data in, it goes through the same type of processing. So your testing data will go through the same vector assemblers, getting the feature vectors, but instead of goes through the logistic regression, it goes through the model you have generated from your training data side, and then give you the prediction, which is your final output here. Essentially, you can access models, so that's exactly the other thing I was doing. So the model is actually contains the model that you predict being learned. And then the label and predictions are all captured in the final result. So why this is a recommended now is for a number of reasons. First of all, the pipeline is a nice capitalization of your workflow. So it's guaranteeing your training data set goes and the testing data set goes through exactly same pre-processing. And then the only difference is whether it is learning or it is a prediction, right? So it's not always easier if you have a lot of pre-processing steps, So if you just without Python, you're pulling them by hand, it's actually not a small chance. You might have some inconsistency before how the thing being trained when versus how the testing data being applied. This could be applied to the different parameters. So the pipeline gives you a way. You only need to change that once. So if you want to select a different features, you don't need to do that when you do the apply the test data side. You change anything in your pipeline, the return result will be changed as well. Okay. So that's one. It's gave you that type of guarantee. It makes the development simpler. And the other thing is, because the estimators, they always have the same function at the place. So you can actually replace the algorithm you want to use into another one. So as some of the examples you may see later is, we can use logistic regression here, and we call the fate functions, but we can create another object, linear regression or do SVM, and then we can don't change other part of pipeline, but just change the how the estimators we want to use when we get into these models. So that's made easier for you to see if you want to experiment in just how different model performs and predicts. Yes?
You might follow the same process where you see Dragon Forest, for example. Instead of logistic integration where you see decision trees or Dragon Forest or any other, we'll follow the same process.
Yeah, it certainly will follow the same process. I have another I can quickly show you is I have another Zappy notebook in the shared materials Ruby. So in here, I have several examples of the classification code. So those are more complex code than the one I showed in the slide. So maybe one thing I can, so in this notebook, the first one is a read data set, it's read a given data set. And this data set is also in the HDFS system right now. It's much bigger than the current data set. And it's what it does is actually a census results from 2000. It's including some of the common features that you include in the census. Like census is a population survey. Say how many people live here, and what's your income level, those sort of things. So you can tell from the column label here. In here is your occupation, your marriage. Marriage status or education level was captured here. So that makes a good practical data set. So you can use it to say, what if I want to predict to see if there's a correlation between income and education levels or income between genders of people. Right? So the first paragraph is to read the data set and show them. Then I have several classifier written in there. Let me quickly show. So they go through more stage. So I have a number of the different index and vector assemblers and to produce more complex features. So here is a part. This is my estimators using decision tree. So I can put them together in here. So I just put them in decision tree. I put them here. I can call model. I can call prediction. I can call evaluations here as well. So it's more complete this time. If I want to change, say, using random forest, here I put them at the two different paragraphs just to show them clearly. But if you compare, it's almost the same. The only thing different is instead of calling create a new decision tree based estimators, I create a new random forest and the rest is, and I use that. I just pop that by into the pipeline and see the same. So you can actually make your own. You see, I just want to run all three of them, and then I want to compare the job. And here I have my UBS classifiers, the largest regressions, and the number of them as well. Okay. So that's exactly one of the nice features about this pipeline approach. It's one is capture your entire workflow, so reduce the chance you will make mistake and make the inconsistency between different trials. And secondly, it's make it easier for you to change or add or your estimators or your assemblers. Any other questions? Okay. So just a quick summary about the MLA is it has a lot of methods being implemented, but by no means it's a complete cover. But from my practical experience, it does contain most popular methods you can think of you want to run. It has some of methods like a decision tree. It also supports several different algorithms there. We can talk about the more details in the next several lectures. It supports classification, regression models, and classing models, and some other methods as well, like collaborative filtering and frequent partial mining series. If there's any particular things you are interested, you have in mind, and you don't know which one you want to try, you can feel free to ask me later. I may be able to give you some suggestions on where to look for. Okay, so this is the end of my slides for introduction for the Spark part. So here I'm basically done with all the big data system platform introductions. Any questions with that, either Hadoop, Spark, and MLA, or thank you. Yes? But Spark streaming, I typically do not introduce them because they are not a very good approach compared to some other streaming component alone. So the one we used is called the Apache Storm. But after the Storm, so the Storm is the Storm streaming is generally two part. One part is to gather the data in an efficient way, because whenever we want to do a streaming analysis, we're usually expecting a lot of concurrent data coming in. Say if you do a Twitter analysis or do a Facebook posting, you might see multiple posting at the same time. It may all push into your receiver end. So a lot of streaming is comes to how you handle those. So once those being, the your process is put into a queue, and once they put into a queue, they are going to be processed separately. The common approach is to do a micro batch processing. So even we do not really process each post at the time they are coming, or each character at the time they are coming. We usually say assemble a small batch of them and to say what's the contribution of this batch to the model we already built before, we update that model and to do that processing. So the process is the data pushing in, you have some type of queue management to distribute in the workload on which task processes which batch of the message. Then after that, you have some way to synthesize the result to update your existing models here. The later part, you can use the Spark to do. Spark is compatible for those. Spark also has a streaming component, but I wouldn't really recommend you to use that. Other questions? Yes?
Does Spark support or the YAML portion support being able to import LNNX models so that we can, for example, work on another tool that we're currently working on, export it, import the model here, and use it for, I guess, running it against the Spark subtools?
Sure. Did you mention the neural network models? Spark doesn't really do anything direct with the deep learning, so it doesn't have efficient processing with a neural network here. And also, I will talk about deep learning as last lecture on Friday mornings. So you will see deep learning is a complete, has a different computational requirements than smart. So you can debug with a deep for the neural network model directly to Spark, but as far as you work on it, it won't be effective. What you want to do more reasonable approach is you're using Spark to collect our data, and using Spark as a way to dispatch those mini batch of the data for your network, for your target, the learning framework for processing them, to catch them without having to Spark. So Spark is a work spider alongside of the learning framework rather than work as an alternative to a learning framework.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. So what I'm planning to do for the rest, so I have three more lecture left. Supposedly now it's 2.5 lecture left. So what I'm planning to do is actually to talk more details about method, machine learning methods here. I have examples like this decision tree that comes with a Zappy and Spark, and you can try and you can use. Since we cannot all go on to the Hadoop clusters, so my rest of lectures I will talk about machine learning method, but actually I'm going to using Jupyter and using Python, and that has a smoother connection to the deep learning world as well. Okay, so let me switch my slides to the other one. So I won't be able to finish this one today, so we will pick up from tomorrow. Okay, so machine learning is a really a buzzword right now, so that's how people really trying to do it, trying to learn it, right? So what is machine learning? Like what I'm trying to ask, what is big data? Machine learning should be more easy to explain, right? Come on, someone tell me what's the machine learning. I don't care if you tell me in Spanish. I just pretend I understand. Yes?
It's an algorithm that learns from an experience and tries to repeat them.
Do you see my definition or do you
know the way?
Your answer is almost the exactly is the definition I'm trying to show. So I'm asking that because the way people just think about it is an algorithm, it's a tool, it's a something, there's something magically from your data. So there are actually a formal definition from computer science research. It's a computer program that is to learn from experience that respect to some tasks and then a performance measure. So it's kind of very obscure and very abstract, but in the more intuitive translation is indeed is something trying to learn from the data, but also the definitions comes with some restriction with it. So it's not everything you do from learn from the data constitutes the machine learning. So for example, technically you run a summary statistics of your data. It's part of analysis. You learn the statistics about your data. So that's a part of learning, but that doesn't really belong to the machine learning. No, it doesn't satisfy. It would improve with respect to some class. It will improve as more data comes or has certain performance markers. It's more what we call a descriptive analysis. Yes, you have a question.
The big data are reduced from
No, big data is not required for machine learning. You can run machine learning even if you just have 10 data points. You can apply the method to it, but the model might be less accuracy. So the more data you have, the generally you can get better machine learning accuracy there. Maybe 5 years ago, there is actually a research paper. What people does is, you know, like in the computer science research, I mean computer science field. So how many of you also in computer science? Just one, just two. No, I see there's my house, there's like computer science. So, like, the people in your size, they are trying to invent new algorithms. You always the same algorithm is better than the previous one, so I can get my paper published. So there was a paper about 5 years ago that actually saying, if we have enough data, the old machine learning algorithm may actually perform similarly. So there's not much of that algorithm difference in terms of accuracy, but more on the performance-wise, how fast you can convert in, how fast you can get in the result, or how easy you can use them. So back to your question is, big data is not required for the machine learning. If you have small data, you could do it. It's just your model is less reliable. The more data you have, then the more reliable your learning result you can count on. So typically, we do have a K-dot threshold, right? So if I have 10 class, then I do want to say maybe at least 100 data points equally sampled from those 10 class for us maybe to do something meaningful, right? If I only have data from 9 class or 5 class, then there's no way I can make a reasonable predictor for the 10 class prediction. But if you're asking whether 1 gigabyte data or 10 gigabyte data will make difference, it will, but the machine learning algorithm may work regardless of the size of data. So that's also the part of the improves with the experience. So a good algorithm should always work first, and then the effectiveness or generality or reliability of the models should improve as you get more experience or more data. Yes.
I heard that too much data from one source may make a prediction a little bit biased.
Yes.
How true is that?
It's very true. If that's your question, it's definitely very true. So that's the reason why I want to have my rest of the slides. So it's the effect is depends on which algorithm you're using, different algorithm based on different ideas. Some ideas may be more affected by the imbalance of the class or imbalance of the distribution of your data. So people typically try to adjust your data through, say, a pre-processing step, and you sample a subset of data from the one you have more class, or you can do the opposite. You can have augmenting the data from the smaller, class you have fewer data and just augmenting that one up. But in general, imbalance of the class distribution, it is a adversary effect to any machine learning algorithm. You want to try to reduce that if possible. But some algorithms like anomaly detections may work on different principles, so that might be different cases. Okay. Any other questions? So continue with machine learning is the concept is the goal of machine learning is we want to learn a general models. So that's what we mean the general model is we may have a bunch of data, and we may come with an explanation to explain this perfectly to fit this data. But that doesn't help us to explain a new data. So if that's a model you only can describe in your existing data, it's not a good model, it's not a good machine learning algorithm. A good machine learning algorithm purpose is not to learn the data you are at hand, how you're describing them, but trying to learn the idea or the unknown process of generating those data, how they do. Only through that way, your model can use to predict the new observations generated from the same process here. Okay? So also you need to be aware that the machine learning models is different than a physical or theoretical models. So is there anyone from physics or aerospace or those engineering department? So in those places, you may also have another research method called simulation-based method. where you have a series about certain things, you have certain hypotheses, and then you can build that model and try to simulate, and then you do experiments and validate to those. So the machine learning, even you can run machine learning on those data, the machine learning won't be able to tell you exactly what's your theoretical models. The machine learning is actually just based on a very simple idea. It's been finding a way to describing the relationships between your data and your label or whatever you want it to be. So it's a way to describing how this point A can turn into point B. So whatever the point it is. So it doesn't necessarily to corresponding to a real physical model or physical series or mathematics behind them. Okay, so that's on one hand, it frees us as a computer science researchers to have different ideas of the machine learning, and we can apply different models to the same thing. But on the other hand, as the users, you need to know the machine learning is only as good as your data, as good as your hypothesis. It doesn't necessarily help you discover a new fundamental physics rules directly, at least. Okay? So we talk about the training and the testing data. So that's the same idea. So typically we need to split the things that we already know. We know 1,000 data points. We don't want to really use all of them for training. And we want to separate some of those out so to do the testing. So that is exactly can let us know how well our models can be applied to some unknown data points, right? So that's for the a lot of learning algorithms, you have the concept of the training and the testing. A typical practical rules people follow is we do this what we call 80-20 split. So we use 80% of the available data at the training data set and using the rest of the data set. So this is just a kind of norm people follow. So you could do 10-90 if you want, or 15-85 if you want, but 80-20 is more normal ways of how systematically done. Okay. So that's just some basics here. Any questions so far? No. Okay. So when we talk about machine learning, do you hear more words or more what other buzzword you heard about there? Alongside machine learning. You don't know what I'm trying to ask. Anyway, so there's a different type of machine learning. I think the most people may heard more maybe machine learning, deep learning, supervised learning, unsupervised learning, sort of things. And then from taxonomy point of view, there's more. There's also reinforcement learning, transfer learning, and so on. For my rest of slides, what my plan is, I gave some quick introduction about the supervised learning, unsupervised learning, and the deep learning at the end. So why we have this kind of further category under the machine learning to dividing them as the supervised learning and the unsupervised learning? It actually applies to when and how they can be applied to the practical problems here. So what you see in this slide is a typical like workflow, how you apply the supervised learning. So that's actually the same thing, the practice example that I show you with my Spark code at last, where we read the card data set, and we separate some training data set in there, and we define one column as a labels. Remember, I specifically casting one column as labels. And then we select your feature vectors, and then we pass that into our logistic regression method, and then we generate your prediction models. Then we have our testing data set passing through the same feature vectors using prediction models and to do the predictions here. Okay? Seems straightforward, right? So the questions I want you to at least think about is in the supervised learning, what exactly we are trying to learn? It's a question right here. Any thoughts or anyone think about that questions before? So we talk about supervised learning, we talk about the machine learning. Yes, we can say we are trying to learn from the data, from the experience to get something. But in this particular case, the supervised learning case, what exactly we are trying to learn here. Or what's the model trying to capture? Yeah, that's actually a pretty good way to say. So dependent on independent variable is a specific term associated with regression analysis, but you can think about it here, because here what we are trying to learn in general is actually the connection or the association between your input data versus your labels. So what we learn is how we go from your input data to this label, why this particular input occurrence between these labels. If you doing regression method based, regression-based learning, what you learn is you will treat label as dependent variables and all the vectors as independent variables, and you are trying to learn all those ways in between. But that's the same idea here, but in the supervised learning, it's actually more than just a linear regression, so there's other ideas being applied. So that's exactly what I'm trying to introduce in the next several slides here. So, but what you are saying is absolutely correct. Is a model is trying to finding explanations why the observed data in the training data set can't have this type of values, can't have this type of labels. Okay, so that's typically back to the classification regressions, and there's a lot of common learning techniques based on ideas. So regression is coming more from the linear method. So we can call them the linear classifiers. There are also other ways you can learn. You have a instance-based functions where we also call non-parametric method. You can have probability-based functions that you are trying to learn. You have a symbolic based ideas. So there's a lot of different ideas how we can learn our explanations. So each one of them may give you good prediction at the end. What they learn is a different explanations, right? So linear method are trying to explain them in a linear equation. The probability functions trying to explain them in a probability distribution format. So I selected several common methods here. So if we have time, what my clients will do a quick overview of those methods and how they does. So we will start with the most simplest ideas about one of the non-parametric methods. Non-parametric means there's really no ways, no parameters you really worry about, because this one is based on instance, it's called continuous neighbors. So the basic idea is we assuming the data live in certain space, right? So if you think about people, right? So people living in Costa Rica, you may share a lot of same things, same values, same food, same taste. So you are definitely more closer than say you and your friend is more than you and me, right? Because I live in a different culture, different background. So that's the same idea you can apply to the data. If assuming we can map in the data into certain system there, then we can assess the distance between them, then the data come close and we can assume they are closer to each other. Right, so that's the most fundamental idea with the nearest neighbor-based classification here. So if we use the nearest neighbor, what we get is we will always assign a unknown data points to assess what the neighbors along it, and based on what we know about these neighbors, and trying to predict what the label is trying to do here. Okay. It's a simple idea. Anyone has questions, please? No? Questions? I forgot to mention. If you go to, so for the rest of the slides, I have the example in Spark, but I mentioned that I want to do it using the Python so we can all get onto the Jupyter Notebook. So I do have the Jupyter Notebook in the shared data directories here. So if you go from here, this link, that's where you download slides. And what you will see is there's iPython notebook, the supervised learning iPython notebooks. Downloading that notebook to your local computer first, then what you can do is you can go to the Jupyter Cloud. You can, I think you'll kill my instance too. So if you can, if you log back to your Jupyter notebook, jupytertype.cloud, you have your instance. What you can do is you can upload the Jupyter notebook, the supervised learning Jupyter notebook, you just download from there. So that's my example. You can upload that one into the cloud. Then where you can see is in here, I basically have the old examples and even some of the results I showed in the slides was actually generating from this Jupyter notebook as well. So little explanation about this notebook is there are some of the graph I'm generating. So the first big chunk big cell just define some visualizations and graph and functions for me. So you don't really need to read too much of it, but you do need to run it once. So it's the function being prompted and fast. So once you bypass the first long one, what you will see is some correspondence to my slides. I have the block for the previous paper classifications. And for all of those examples, what I'm using is using the second learn. So it's a Python library that has a lot of machine learning support as well. It's very good and very nice. And you can, if you want to learn Python to machine learning, you can start from here. And a lot of the interface is very similar to Spark. And also you can call them from the Spark as well. And using the PySpark, you can import second learn and you can use them here too. For my examples, I was using a built-in website on Iris. So it's basically a flowers and it has a different characters. I think there are four different types of or three different types of flowers. It's one of the built-in data sites. And later, maybe in the afternoon, we can try to have some other data site for the practice. For the most part, it's quite similar. So here you can see something like similar interface as Spark, right? They have a feed function, they have transform functions, and then you want to apply your models, you define the models, say your linear neighbor classifiers here, and you can fit that, give your data as input, and you can manipulate it, and then you get in a output call. So when you look more closer, you'll find a lot of the similarities in the code structures, secular Python versus the Spark as well. So I decide for the next option, I want to use this as an example, so you can feel free to try to follow along with my slides and some maybe helps help you to understand the neighbors. So for the nearest neighbors, the idea of the doing classification is fairly easy. But one thing I want you to have sort of idea with is the idea of the classification boundaries. Okay, so that's a concept existing in all the classification algorithms. It's a design to say. So go back to my slides. That's one what we show here. So in this case, it's considering a simple binary classification case. Just a two-dimensional. Here we're just using a two-dimensional function into a two-dimensional grid, and we color them into two paths, the one in yellow and one in black. So for the nearest the neighbors, if we only choose the nearest one, what we can do is in this space you're seeing here, you pick any points, we can calculate in nearest the point, the nearest the long points, whether it's yellow or whether it's black, right? So we can do the same coloring to 2A, so that will be looks like this. So which means this point, the close neighbor is a yellow class. And for this, it's going to be a black class, and we didn't really color it here. And then so in the case of the blank, is where the mirror sniffer should be a black sniffers, okay? So what you see here is sort of form that the decision boundaries, which means that if your data for in here, it will be a yellow class, and if your data for in the space here, it will be a black class, okay? Understood? It's a clear? Okay, yes. Yes, that's a good question, right? So that's what we want to do. So in this case, we're just doing it for one year's neighbors. And what you will notice is there are going to be a lot of confusions here because move a little bit further, you may get to a different classes here. So that's coming back to the general question is a choice of the how many, when we say k nearest neighbors, it doesn't necessarily mean k equals to one, k equals to many things. So that one, if you consider them further in a different context, so it's a one-year's neighbor, can easily give you different number of K, can easily give you different number of the class label results. That's because when you do differently, what you change is actually the classification boundaries, right? So if you go back to this pictures, when your neighbor is equal to one, your classification boundaries is sort of more interweaving with others. You do not see a very smooth interface separation here, so that's corresponding to the case. In your space, or in some part of your data space, the classification will be really unreliable. It depends on where is our change to change the class. Okay, so typically we want to avoid this type of interweaving cases in classification boundaries. Then when we increase the neighbors to five, we kind of can see we certainly try to smooth out and make the decision boundaries more separate, be more smooth. So that's we still have the sensitive areas. We always have the kind of the less reliable areas in along the boundaries of the two class. So whenever you have this class here. Moving a slightly little back to the right and changing the class, so that always change. So one of the things in terms of the algorithm structure and which algorithm is less desirable is trying to see which one can give you a classification boundary that most acceptable between the class you have. Okay? So I want so you may not always be able to visualizing your classification boundaries. But I want to show that this is a really good example to show them, to give you the ideas what really makes things different. It's how different algorithms, why someone is more accurate and someone is less accurate. And also, it's not always it's not to say the k-nearest neighbor is not always unreliable. If your testing data is always false to two ends of the spectrum, then k-nearest neighbor may actually be very useful, right? So if they are far away from the same boundary, that's still useful. So that's a kind of concept you should have for any of the classifications, how separable of the different classes. It's a thing to consider. I do have this part of code in my Python notebook for the decision boundaries. You can actually try to explore on your own. You can change to what neighbors and what the decision boundary looks like, two neighbors, what looks like. In my slide, I show 1 and 5, but you can try more, 10, 13, and 15. And at some point, it may be less effective. There are misclassification errors, you'll start to see them. So the peer's neighbor is a very simple idea, but it can help you to understand and illustrate a lot of common pitfalls with the machine learning algorithms in general. Okay, so actually, I have one with a neighbors equals to 10. So you see, in this one, it's quite different with the previous two. So previous one was always not really two power, but three power. There's one on the left here. And if we do 10, there's actually very small, even we have the data here, the contribution of them, because there are so few of them, is much less. Right? So we almost get to the left and right in that case. So that's how the choice of k matters. But also, is that there's no good answer to say, I always choose 10, I always choose 5. So that's something you need to explore on your own. So this is could be a way, and there are other ways how you to see the confusions and which one can be better for you, and the FICO scores. Okay. So some other concerns in general associated with this type of classification is called the instance-based classification. Not just painters' neighbors, there's other ways so you can hashing your data into another space. So say you can convert your data into another hash code and then you can compare them. So that's another way of doing the instance-based classifier as well. So some general concerns and limitations when this method doesn't really active people is it works well with the lower dimensional data, which means you have a less columns, less properties. The distance is easier and more separable, so that might be applicable, but it becomes less effective if your data became higher dimension, you have a lot of variables, a lot of parameters. And the other thing to consider is there are always certain distance measures you are trying to apply to assess the closeness between two instances, right? So in my example, we're just using simple Euclidean distance to do that. But there's literally a number of the other mathematical distance you can choose, and you can also define your own distance, how you can do that. So the whether your distance or similarity measure is really good is another good factor, is another big factor to affect whether the model is accurate or reliable or not. The example I'm showing here is just to say, with a given two different vector representations, you may have a different idea to say, this may be more close to each other, or this may be more close to each other, but they all reveal the same distance measure if you choose just using the basic cosine similarity measures. Okay, so yeah, I think it's actually 12 talks. So I'm just going to stop here. So I'm looking. The rest is so I have rigorous analysis, corresponding to linear model based analysis with classifiers. The idea is different, and the surface-based analysis and the decision tree-based classification, they all based on different ideas. So I do want to give you a quick tour of all of them. So we will pick up on tomorrow from here, along with the unsupervised learning method and deep learning. Okay, so time to lunch. So, any questions then? Maybe a good time for you to quiet and you can cover me the method of the important is. Actually, if someone can quiet, I mean, if it works good, that would be great. But I'm not sure the package I'm using, the distance or the type of amount, if there's a get error to say now finding second nerve or nothing for I don't call something in the let me know so I can tell you how we can import the library. So if you can download the notebook, start the server, upload the latest in, and then if you appear here and you will start to run on notebooks. You may want to start the server anyway, because after two sessions, we're going to use them again. So maybe just go to the Jupyter cache file here, start my server again. Okay? Can you see?